bona fide genius. When I tell people about my life in Scarborough, the first question they ask is, where were the parents? Billy's home life was dreadful. He was often scolded and humiliated by his mom. His dad was a no-show, and then, of course, there were Mummy's special sleepover friends. He was left unattended most of the time, which for us meant that his basement was our playhouse. This period of time, my unattended juvenile delinquent years in Scarborough, is the basis of everything that I wanted to include in the Wayne's World movies. Where were their parents? I love hockey, but I didn't play ice hockey seriously until I was 30. My Scarborough years were all about street hockey, floor hockey, table hockey, and watching Hockey Night in Canada. From my earliest memory, I've loved the Toronto Maple Leafs. I love the name. I love that we wear blue. I love the maple leaf. I love the grammatical idiosyncrasy of the name of the team. I love the little maple leaf on the shoulders of the team's sweater. And I love the three broad stripes surrounded by two narrow stripes on our hockey socks. I love how a Maple Leafs player looks on a table hockey table, on a hockey card, on a power player stamp. I love the look of Maple Leaf Gardens, that Art Deco masterpiece. I love the Gardens marquee, and I love Doug Laurie Sports, the souvenir and sporting goods shop inside. I loved Hockey Night in Canada's gondola, the broadcast booth precariously suspended from the ceiling of the gardens. I love the Hockey Night in Canada theme. I think the Hockey Night in Canada theme could be a good backup for O Canada. I love the old Hockey Night in Canada logo, the side stick one. I always wanted to get a powder blue Hockey Night in Canada blazer with the side stick logo embroidered on the pocket. I love Don Cherry. Coach's Corner is a mainline hit of Canadiana, and Ron McLean's Canadian accent is so thick that even I have a hard time understanding it sometimes. I loved Danny Gallivan and his cannonading drives, scintillating saves, and Savardian spinoramas. And then, of course, there were fantastic moments like the time Hockey Night in Canada experimented with putting a camera and microphone on the players' bench, forgetting, of course, that hockey players take trash talk to a cruel and offensive extreme. The first time they cut to the bench in a game, a young, toothless Bobby Clark admonished referee Bruce Hood, saying, "Why don't you go fuck yourself, Hood, you fucking queer?" That experiment was quickly abandoned. No more bench cam. I'm not a great skater. I was a pretty good soccer player, but street hockey was my game. Our North York apartment building had a team, and we would play the townhouses that were next door. We played in their run-down tennis court, which for us was a rink of dreams. You could shoot on net, and if you missed, you didn't have to run 100 yards to retrieve the ball. The watertight surface meant that if everyone slap-shotted away the puddles after it rained, we could be up and running within 15 minutes. Our goalie pads were made of stolen or found sofa cushions. A baseball glove was the goalie glove, and a blocker was made out of an egg carton duct-taped to a hockey glove. If you pretended to be hurt, you were a faker. The only thing worse than being a faker was being a hacker. A hacker was somebody who hacked at your stick incessantly. If you hung out by the other team's goal and never came back to play defense, you were a goal suck, and only a dink would take a slap shot from 2 feet out. Our biggest fear was being squared, which was getting hit in the nuts. Why does getting hit in the nuts give you a stomach ache? The worst thing was to over-celebrate your goal, because then you would be considered conceited, eh? We didn't have a lot of money for hockey gear. I remember the day when I went from Hespeler hockey sticks bought at Canadian Tire to plastic Mylek blades that you would curve at home over the stove. Every one of my Mylek blades ended up with concentric circle stove burns. At school, it was a day to be celebrated when gym class let you play floor hockey with the plastic sticks and hollow plastic pucks. If you could raise a hollow plastic puck, you were a god. I was a floor hockey god. At recess, we traded hockey cards. One guy would shuffle through his stack, showing you what he had, to which you would say, got him, need him, got him, checklist. Checklist was an informational card that just listed all of the players that made a complete set. I once traded a Davy Keon for a checklist, using my brother Peter's stack by accident. "You traded my Keon for checklist?" To which I replied, "Checklist is a card, and I have 4 Keons." In reality, checklist was not a card. I had failed. At the end of the season, after someone had laboriously completed a full set, the hockey cards would be thrown up in the air. Kindergarten kids would frantically pick them up, cracking heads as they did so. By June, if you're a Leafs fan, the season is over. Truthfully, it's usually over by December. Every year, the Leafs have a great team on paper, but unfortunately, hockey is played on ice. Similarly, every September, the Toronto Press have the Leafs winning the Stanley Cup, but alas, the Stanley Cup is not until June. By that time, my thoughts would have turned away from hockey and toward the summer, which meant the Canadian National Exhibition, the CNE, or even shorter, the X. All year long, I save up my X money, and this could be supplemented by X dollars, which were promotional scrip printed in the Toronto Telegram. By going to the garbage chute room and rifling through discarded telegrams, my brothers and I could cut out an extra $50 each. In reality, only 10 X dollars were ever honored. Most places at the X wanted real money. The CNE was an old fair. Even by the 70s, it looked like it needed a lick of paint. It seemed permanent, but somehow temporary, like a downmarket Disney World representation of the British Empire. But to me, it was exotic, worldly. I felt like James Joyce's character in the short story Araby from his Dubliners collection. In the story, Araby was the name of the run-down, Arabia-themed bazaar in the heart of the otherwise dull and drab Dublin. It was a magic zone where anything could happen. You entered the CNE through the majestic Beaux-Arts masterpiece known as the Prince's Gate, or as the kids in Scarborough called it, the Princess Gate. This gate was, in many ways, more ornate and impressive than the Brandenburg Gate in Berlin. Once past the gate, your free admission ticket that came with your report card accepted, you were in the heart of the Midway. The Midway was the main street that had all the rides. The Flyer was the premier roller coaster. Wooden, rickety, a fire trap. I rode it, and I survived it. Another roller coaster, the Wildcat, was a cool, modern, tubular roller coaster and was okay but not worth the long line. The Wild Mouse, on the other hand, was narrow-gauged, dubiously constructed with corners and drop-offs that defied physics. Rumor had it that 20 children in Europe had been killed on the Wild Mouse. Morbid. So the Wild Mouse needed to be tamed. I passed this rite du passage with flying colors. Blaring from the speakers of the bobsled ride was a police siren and warning bells augmented by a deafening disc jockey who kept saying, "Do you want to go faster?" The bobsled itself was fast but disappointing because it only went around in a circle backwards. I'm not certain how that made it a bobsled, and the only thing I remember was the annoying disc jockey repeatedly saying, "Do you want to go faster?" Even today, if I say, "Do you want to go faster?" any Torontonian immediately will say, "The bobsled." That's one of two catchphrases that the CNE had. The other catchphrase came from a guy who sold trick animal leashes, which he claimed were invisible dogs. All day long, with the aid of a heavily distorted microphone, he sing-songed the same two words, "Doggy, doggy." By the time you went home, you were convinced your name was Doggy, Doggy. My strongest recollection, which I'm sure is wrong, is that the Midway blasted Lady Marmalade by LaBelle on an endless loop. And because my brothers and I took French in school, we knew the raunchy-sounding chorus went, "Do you want to go to bed with me tonight?" It was awesome. Less clear, however, was the English translation of "Gitchy, gitchy, ya, ya, dada." The sideshows on the Midway were remarkably shoddy. Years of apathy had taken their toll on the quality of the haunted houses. They weren't scary, they were sad. One haunted house on a tractor trailer had a scary greeter, which, through years of neglect, was now just a guy with long, greasy hair, a denim jacket, sloppily applied kiss makeup, smoking a butt, reading the Toronto Sun. As you passed him, without looking up from the hockey page, he would blow out a puff of smoke and give you a perfunctory, monotone, boo. I demand more of my haunted houses. Next to the Midway, in the more permanent buildings, were trade shows. There was the Better Living Center, where I first saw a push-button phone, and the old British Art Deco-styled automotive building, which we called the Avtomotive Bevilding, not realizing that the V's were actually U's from the classical carving style. Inside the automotive building, car makers would give you free promotional mini cars. We, of course, lamented that there were no Canadian cars. We were, however, heartened to see a Canadian Armed Forces pavilion, a Canadian dairy kiosk, free ice cream, the Hockey Hall of Fame, where the Stanley Cup permanently lived, and various trade displays, including one from Communist China, which both frightened and fascinated me. My father sold the Encyclopedia Britannica at the CNE. I loved visiting him. I was so proud of how funny he was with the customers. Selling was his milieu, but the real action was at the food building, where Canadian food products were sold at promotional prices. You could get a big box of double bubble gum for 25 cents. A giant jar of honey was 40 cents. Pepsi was a nickel. My tradition was to get a back bacon on a bun from Schneider's. Back bacon is what Americans call Canadian bacon. It has a pea meal coating, which is just cornmeal that soaks up all the bacony flavor during frying. I would put a dash of HP sauce on it, which would be soaked up by the lightly toasted Kaiser roll. Heaven. One year, I had budgeted my money perfectly. I had left just enough for my back bacon on a bun. But when I got to the counter, the price had gone up by 40 cents. The 20-year-old dude working the concession stand read my face perfectly. He said, "Hey, kid, I get one of these a day. Here, take it." I couldn't believe the generosity. It shaped my worldview at the time and was part of my coming of age. With the extra money, I got a milkshake from the Nielsen Dairy Stand, went to the War of 1812 cannons on the lakeshore, and savored every morsel. Another year, when I was super young, I saw Mel Prophet, an offensive end for the Toronto Argonauts of the Canadian Football League. The Argos used to play at CNE Stadium. I loved the old double blue Argos uniform with a simple A on the helmet. I was nervous to approach Mel because he was a giant, and he was the first celebrity I had ever met. But he was nice to me, even though I was a little kid, and even though nobody was looking. But the main attraction at the CNE was all the older teenage girls from around Toronto. They came from exotic locales with names like Mimico, Etobicoke, Mississauga, Thornhill, East York, Hogs Hollow, Forest Hill, Humber Valley, Pickering, New Toronto, Don Mills, York Mills, Flemington Park, and Moss Park. These Midway beauties were all identical. They all had Farrah Fawcett hair, blue eyeshadow, feather earrings, super tight GWG jeans, halter tops, and were replete with the fragrance of Tickle deodorant and Dr. Pepper chapstick. They all seemed like movie stars to me. By the time I was old enough to go to the CNE with an actual real-life girlfriend, I rarely ran out of money because I had continued to do Canadian television commercials. One of the commercials I did was for Wrigley Spearmint Gum. Even though it was for the Canadian market, it was shot in Los Angeles, days before Christmas. I remember seeing Santa decorations affixed to palm trees. The commercial is set in an overnight camp. There's a camp counselor, and I play one of the campers. The unfortunate part was that the dialogue went as follows. Camp counselor: "Hey, Joey." Me: "Hey, Jack, want some gum?" Camp counselor: "Candy flavored?" Me: "No, it's Wrigley's." Camp counselor: "Oh, you graduated to the big stick." Now, the big stick in question, of course, is Wrigley's gum, but when you're 12 years old in Scarborough, your friends see the big stick a little differently. Word got out that I was Joey from the TV commercial. Kids I'd never met at school would come up to me and say, "Hey, are you Joey?" Reluctantly, I'd say, "Yes." "I hear you graduated to the big stick." "Fuck you, faggot." It was tough. There were fights. I won many of them. The low point was during final exams. Three different kids interrupted the quiet exam room by shouting into the classroom, "Which one's Joey?" My classmates gave me up immediately. Nice big stick, faggot! It was my first catchphrase, and would not be my last. In fact, everything I did, even as a child, ended up being a catchphrase at school. When I did a guest spot on The Littlest Hobo, a show about a stray dog that goes from town to town, I had the line, "Wow, that dog's a real frisbee hound." Unfortunately, my thick Canadian accent made it sound like frisbee hound. So I was treated to, "Hey, that dog's a real frisbee hound." Then I was the host of a disco show on local TV called Boogie Junior, which my English mother insisted on calling Boogie Junior. I was a heavy metal kid. I loved Zeppelin, Rush, and a local band called Max Webster. I was miserable hosting a disco show. At one point, the producer encouraged me to loosen up, and so I introduced the song Dance the Kung Fu while waving my arms around doing kung fu moves. As a result, the microphone only picked up every second word, and my intro ended up sounding like Ants Ung Oo. From that point on, if I ever got too full of myself, my brothers would put me in my place by saying, "Ants Ung Oo." Or if they really wanted to tear me down, they would set me up with things like, "That's really smart, Mike. Did you learn that from that Chinese philosopher?" And I would say, "What Chinese philosopher?" And they'd say, "You know, the Chinese philosopher Ants Ung Oo." Ego death. In 1975, I was on King of Kensington playing a Canadian Boy Scout, con man, who rips Al Waxman off. The catchphrase from that show was me telling Al Waxman, "Shove off, fat boy!" By the time I started high school, I had lost interest in show business. It had less to do with the taunting and more to do with the fact that I had gone to England by myself in the summer of 1977, the year punk rock broke in London. My cousins, north of London, had taken me to a punk club, gotten me drunk, and had purchased for me the Sex Pistols single God Save the Queen. I was hooked. It was raw, quirky, fun, and funny. The only problem was that my dad, a staunch monarchist, would never let a record featuring the lyrics "God Save the Queen, She Ain't No Human Being" into his proper English house. I ended up putting the Sex Pistols single into a Jimi Hendrix sleeve. Little did I know, my father was a giant Hendrix fan, likening Jimi Hendrix's guitar prowess to Django Reinhardt. The Sex Pistols single was immediately found and confiscated, but my love of punk was unabated. My first high school, Sir John A. Macdonald Collegiate Institute, was in Scarborough and was named after Canada's first Prime Minister. It was a heavy metal school, very macho, lots of long hair, people wearing flared jeans. Like many suburban schools, conformity was king. As a punk rocker with short spiky hair, a leather jacket, and ripped tapered black jeans, I stuck out. My social life was not in the suburbs, it was downtown, where there were other punks, cool record stores, and Toronto's fantastic second-run cinema scene, which comprised between 8 and 10 amazing old theaters that projected themed double features like The Seventh Seal and The Seven Samurai, or 400 Blows and Jean-Luc Godard's Breathless. My best friend Dave McKenzie's classmate at McDonald was a guy named David Furnish. I remember seeing David Furnish in the halls, and I thought he was a nice dude, but he was a year younger than me, and sometimes, in high school, that creates a weird separation. Many years later, I would meet that same David Furnish again. I was at my first Hollywood party, right after finishing the movie Wayne's World. It was Elton John's Oscar party, and I had never seen so many famous people in one room. Oliver Stone, Sean Connery, Rob Lowe, Sharon Stone, Demi Moore, Sylvester Stallone. It was weird. Elton John shouted in my direction, "You, I've been waiting for you." As a joke, I turned to my friends and said, "Yeah, Elton's been expecting me." Then Elton John said, "Mike Myers, there's someone I want you to meet." I didn't know anybody at this party, but there was one guy who looked like David Furnish. And then David, in his Canadian accent, said, "Hey, Mike, it's me, David Furnish, David McKenzie's friend." I went, "Holy shit, are we out of context?" And then David Furnish said, "We're a long way from Scarborough, eh, buddy?" And I said, "Indeed." He said, "Isn't it weird? You're a movie star and I'm Elton John's wife, eh?" I said, "It's all weird, buddy." He said, "Bet you didn't know I was gay, eh?" And I said, I didn't know, but I didn't care. I just remember him being like a very, very cool guy. On a side note, Elton is a sports fan, having once owned the English soccer team Watford FC. At that party, he and I had the most in-depth conversation about what the Leafs needed to do to turn that organization around. With encyclopedic knowledge, he went player by player through the Leafs roster. By some stroke of good luck, I had spent the day reading my hockey news. While at Sir John A. Macdonald Collegiate, I'd heard about another high school in the suburbs of Scarborough named Stephen Leacock Collegiate Institute. Leacock had a million-dollar television studio on campus. I wanted to be a movie director, so I transferred to Leacock and took the TV course, which was fantastic. On the weekends, I went downtown and was the opening comedy act for punk bands at various clubs around the city. On that scene was a punk band called Latron J that was getting a nice following. They were very political in that clash way. Two members of L'Étranger, Andrew Cash and Chuck Angus, also went to Leacock. I remember talking politics with them and bonding with them over the duality of our suburban school weeks and downtown punk weekends. Both went on to become members of the Canadian Parliament. I started to try to include the suburban downtown duality in my act. I created a character based on all of my suburban heavy metal friends from Scarborough. I tried to think of the most Canadian name possible, and I came up with Wayne Campbell. One of the great bands in the Toronto punk scene, Drastic Measures, let me open for them as Wayne Campbell on several occasions. Their lead singer, Tony Malone, was hilarious in his own right and a brilliant songwriter. He was a source of tremendous encouragement to me. Thank you, Tony. Also roaming the halls of Leacock was an aspiring young actor named Eric McCormick. He was in the theater clique, or clique as they say in America, which I knew tangentially. But I was more into comedy than drama. Of course, McCormick, a brilliant comedic actor, would go on to star in the hit television show Will and Grace. Ironically, Eric later went to McDonald and became friends himself with David Furnish. It's a small world, but when all three of us Scarborough boys bumped into each other many years later at the Cannes Film Festival, it felt tiny. By now, I had started to take the Second City Theater Workshop program. It's from this program that people were hired for the Second City Touring Company, the junior company of the Second City Main Stage Company that performed 8 shows a week, 6 nights a week, at the landmark Old Fire Hall. The workshops were awesome, challenging, educational, and I ended up making the acquaintance of the brilliant Dave Foley, who was taking workshops and beginning to form the kids in the hall. It was an exciting time of music, comedy, and movies. I went to the movies 3 times a week, took workshops 2x a week, and met Dave Foley for coffee, learning everything I could from the man I consider the smartest person I've ever met. Meanwhile, at school, the government required that you take an aptitude test. It was 20 pages long, and the results of your test were sent to Ottawa, Canada's capital, for assessment by a government employee who would tell you what they thought you should do for a living. For shits and giggles, I decided to answer all the questions as truthfully as possible. I was curious to find out what career Ottawa thought I should pursue. I suspected it would be either architecture or photography. My results came in. The Canadian government thought I was best suited to be a movie star. Not an actor, not a comedian, a movie star. I had applied to York University in Toronto for a fine arts degree in film to study to become a director. I was also invited to audition for the Second City Touring Company. If hired, I would become a full-time actor. Ironically, my audition was scheduled for my last day of high school. That morning, I woke to find a letter of acceptance from York University. At 9 a.m., I had my last exam of high school. At noon, I had my audition for the Second City Touring Company. And at 3 p.m., I was hired for Second City. It was 1982, and I was still living at home in Scarborough. I ended up not going to York University. I was a professional actor. I was an adult now. I was 19. I knew what I was going to do next with my life, but I was wondering what Canada was going to do next. When we were kids in Scarborough during the 60s and 70s, we were told that Canada was going to be, and I quote, the next great nation. I've decided to call this time in Canadian history between 1967 and 1976 the Next Great Nation Era. During this time, the Canadian government undertook a massive nationwide initiative to answer the fundamental Canadian questions, who are we and why are we? It was a bold attempt, but what was it exactly? And did it work? Part 2. Patriot. Chapter 3. The Next Great Nation. While it was clearly America's century, there was a brief time between 1967 and 1976 when Canadians faced their identity malaise head-on. We sought to define ourselves by achieving greatness. Greatness in the arts, in architecture, in urban design, and progressivism. It was during this brief 9-year period that the Canadian government enacted far-reaching policies to individuate ourselves from Mother Europe and Brother America in the hopes of defining our identity, and in that definition, perhaps a mission statement. In 1967, I was 4 years old. In 1976, I was 13. These were my formative years, and the Next Great Nation era was Canada's formative years. Remarkably, at around the same time, 1966, in Red China, Chairman Mao Zedong had also undertaken an ambitious governmental effort to redefine his country's identity, the Cultural Revolution, in which several million Chinese people were killed. Canada's cultural evolution was much less violent, resulting in only half a dozen terrible television shows. Sure, they were terrible, but they were our terrible television shows. For Americans, such big government spending on culture is unthinkable, and, because of their clear mission statement, it's unnecessary. The Declaration of Independence clearly guarantees Americans life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The British North America Act offers Canadians peace, order, and good government. Not as sexy and hardly a guarantee, but we do have a history of peace and order. Is this a good thing? I'm reminded of the speech that Orson Welles improvised for his character Harry Lime in the 1949 film The Third Man. Harry Lime. In Italy, for 30 years, under the Borgias, they had warfare, terror, murder, and bloodshed, but they produced Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, and the Renaissance. In Switzerland, they had brotherly love. They had 500 years of democracy and peace. And what did that produce? The cuckoo clock. Has Canada been relegated to cuckoo clock status? Can one legislate one's way to an identity? Have civility and big government stunted our cultural growth? Well, from 1967 to 1976, Canada was going to find out, because unlike our neighbors to the south, Canada has never had a fear of big government. One example is the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, or CBC, which was created and paid for by the Canadian government in 1936. In 1967, the CBC began creating TV programs by and for Canadians. The CBC is an enigma wrapped in a bureaucracy. However frustrating we who toil in the fields of comedy find the CB, it does fulfill its mandate and has created a situation whereby Canadians interested in the television industry and all of its related occupations can learn. The great Canadian author Malcolm Gladwell, in his book Outliers, makes the observation that it takes 10,000 hours of practice to master any given art form. For example, the Beatles became the Beatles by spending 10,000 hours in Hamburg, Germany, free from the scrutiny of British society. When they returned to Liverpool, they were ready to become the four lads who shook the world. The CBC allows Canadians to master their craft before shaking the world. Case in point is the CBC show Dr. Zonk and the Zunkins from 1974, which featured an as-yet-unknown Gilda Radner and soon-to-be-discovered John Candy. Then a year later, another show, Coming Up Rosie, from 1975, starred the great Canadians Dan Aykroyd and Catherine O'Hara, both of whom were not yet famous. In the show, Dan Aykroyd played a character named Purvis Bickle, who was a Scottish superintendent. I loved this character. Purvis Bickle made me want to do Scottish characters. Dan Aykroyd is a brilliant character comedian whose attention to detail is next to none. One of my favorite Dan Aykroyd characters is Fred Garvin, male prostitute. Again, as a Canadian, I recognized his accent to be that of the Ottawa Valley. In my head, the Ottawa Valley accent is the Canadian accent. I worship him. TV shows in Canada don't pay in money, they pay in 10,000 hours of practice. And while there isn't gold in them thar hills, there is the consolation that creative work done in Canada doesn't count against your career. A list of Canadian actors, filmmakers, and producers who have benefited directly or indirectly from the CBC and all the other government-funded arts programs reads as follows. Wayne and Schuster, Mort Saul, Lauren Green, James Cameron, Norman Jewison, Dan Aykroyd, Ryan Gosling, Tommy Chong, David Steinberg, Rich Little, Rick Moranis, Dave Thomas, Martin Short, Eugene Levy, William Shatner, that's right, Kirk is Canadian, Michael J. Fox, Howie Mandel, my dear friends Phil Hartman and Dave Foley, Bruce McCullough, Kevin MacDonald, Mark McKinney, Scott Thompson, Nia Vardalos, Ellen Page, Leslie Nielsen, Jim Carrey, Tom Green, Colin Mochrie, Norm MacDonald, Ryan Reynolds, Seth Rogen, Will Arnett, Michael Cera, and last but not least, Mr. Lorne Michaels. I'm humbled to be part of this list, and I feel like I have the great privilege to do what I do because of big government. That's some list. That's some cuckoo clock. The governmental programs of the next great nation era inspired all levels of Canadian society. We wanted to take our seat at the world table. In 1967, Canada turned 100. A wave of patriotism spread throughout the nation. It was an exciting time to be Canadian. One of the peaks of that excitement was that Montreal hosted the 1967 World's Fair, known as Expo 67. Its motto was Man and His World. Canada had gone global. Each country had its own pavilion. America sported one of the world's first Buckminster Fuller geodesic domes, an engineering marvel that still delights the eye and the intellect. Canada's pavilion looked like an inverted pyramid. To this day, I try to understand the significance of that shape. I'm guessing the inverted pyramid is meant to represent some sort of elevation of the working class. My family and I gave the Canadian Pavilion the nickname the Candy Dish. Much to my family's terror, at the age of 4, I got lost in the USSR Pavilion, to which my brother Paul exclaimed, "Michael's gone into the Soviet Pavilion. I think he's going to defect." While it's true that Soviet defection was something I had been threatening to do, even as early as 2 years old, alas, my loyalties were, and continue to be, to the West. As I've said since grade 1, big government is one thing, but a proletarian dictatorship is beyond the pale. My family collected every possible souvenir connected to Expo 67. I still keep an Expo 67 coin in my wallet. I love Montreal, and I love that it's part of Canada. That same year, 1967, Montreal gave Canada another gift. A young Minister of Justice, under Prime Minister Lester Pearson, announced that Canada was legalizing divorce, abortion, and homosexuality. When asked by the press, "Under what mandate can you propose such sweeping changes in Canadian social policy?" the young Minister of Justice responded confidently, "There's no place for the state in the bedrooms of the nation." That Minister of Justice, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, was elected Prime Minister of Canada in the following year, 1968, and Canada was forever changed. As Kennedy was to America, Trudeau was to Canada, and in several ways, even more so. Due to the dynamic nature of our parliamentary system of government, Trudeau was able to enact much more progressive legislation immediately and without opposition. In 1968, Trudeau's government passed the Canadian content laws that required a certain percentage of media content seen or heard by Canadians to be at least partially created or produced by Canadians. It came to be known as CanCon. Literally, the government, in the name of creating a Canadian identity, would mandate what could or could not be seen or heard on television or radio. From an American standpoint, this is no different than Mao's Cultural Revolution. But the vast majority of Canadians, swept up in Trudeau mania, felt a sense of urgency to begin to create a distinct cultural identity. It didn't feel like tyranny. It felt like empowerment, Perhaps in Pierre Trudeau, Canada now had its long-awaited dramaturge. CanCon dictated that radio stations had to play a percentage of, quote, Canadian music. CanCon supplied the definition of, quote, Canadian, under the MAPL system. MAPL, or MAPL, is an acronym of Music, Artist, Performance, and Lyrics. It meant that in order to qualify as Canadian content, music must have at least two of the following. M, the music is written by a Canadian. A, the music is, or the lyrics are, performed by a Canadian artist. P, the musical selection consists of a performance that is recorded in Canada or performed in Canada and broadcast live in Canada. And L, the lyrics are written by a Canadian. By now, freedom-loving Americans hearing this have already put one of their many guns in their mouth, both because of the intention of a law by which a government would mandate culture, and certainly by the Byzantine wording of that law. For Canadians, we felt a thrill that our collective voice could be heard over the din of our noisy neighbors to the south. Even private companies got into the act. In the 1960s and 70s, Sam the Record Man was a massive record store in Toronto. At the height of Sam the Record Man's popularity, there were 130 stores across Canada. The flagship store in Toronto featured a pair of three-story signs in the shape of vinyl records with sequenced neon lights that gave the illusion that these giant records were spinning. That alone, to a seven-year-old, was enough. It felt like show business. It was exciting. There was a Canadian section in the store, and I would often buy albums, sight unheard, just to give them a chance because they were Canadian. One of those bands was the Stampeders, who ended up having a hit with the song Sweet City Woman in 1973, which reached number one on the Canadian charts and number eight on the U.S. charts. I even got into jazz by way of Sam the Record Man's Canadian section. One day, I bought an album by the Canadian jazz pianist Oscar Peterson. I didn't know anything about jazz, but Oscar Peterson was Canadian, so I bought it, and, by the way, loved it, even though, at the time, I was exclusively into rock. The Sam in Sam the Record Man was Sam Snyderman, a Canadian hero who simply asked the question, why not from Canada? And this question was spreading like wildfire in Canada, even to the point of product promotions. The Canadian subsidiary of the 7-Up company had a promotion called Rock Caps. At the bottom of every specially marked can of 7-Up, there was the name and face of a Canadian rock band member. The bands were Lighthouse, The Guess Who, April Wine, Crowbar, and Edward Bear. My brothers, Peter Paul and I, were obsessed. We found ourselves rummaging through the garbage looking for 7-Up cans. Our hands were bloodied because of how hard it is to cut open the bottom of a pop can. We ran the risk of tetanus and other opportunistic infections, but in the end, we got Don DeNovo, the violinist of the rock band Lighthouse, and our collection was complete. We were looking inward, claiming and naming Canadian bands. Joni and Neil were already in the States planting the flag, but now it felt like their U.S. residency was less of an exile and more of a beachhead for these new Canadian recording artists. Similarly, Shell gas stations in Canada offered commemorative medallions featuring the Prime Ministers of Canada. The goal was to collect all, at that time, 15 Prime Ministers. My favorite Prime Minister was Charles Tupper. The only thing I knew about Tupper was that he had giant Brooklyn-style mutton chops. To this day, if my brother Paul and I see a guy with mutton chops, we will say, he's sporting a fine Tupper. Previous to 1967, the only time you learned about Canadian history was in a classroom. We were attempting to do what Americans do, sewing history into culture. In 1970, Esso Canada created a hockey card promotion called Esso Power Players. Whenever you filled up your tank, you received a packet of Power Player hockey stickers to fill a Power Player album. Power Players were a phenomenon. I was addicted, and while some of the NHL players were American, and I think there was one European, a Finn named Juha Viiding, the vast majority of the players were from Canada. These were Canadian heroes, and you could only get these stickers in Canada. Americans had baseball cards. We had Power Players. One of my strongest Canadian childhood memories involved Power Players. A friend and I were waiting by the pumps of an Esso gas station at the corner of Shepherd Avenue and Don Mills Road in North York. It was freezing, mid-December. There was a sheet of snow on the ground, and we could see the Christmas lights at Fairview Mall across the way. On the balconies of the rental apartments that surrounded us, tenants had strung up numerous strands of Christmas tree lights into the shape of 7-story-high martini glasses. It was one of those inky, dark, silent winter nights that you only get in Canada. Falling snow made cones of light from the streetlights above. I was starting to lose feeling in my toes and my moon boots. My GWG jeans were frozen solid, and my checked bomber jacket was starting to let in the cold. My Toronto Maple Leafs toque was the only thing keeping me in the game. We hid behind the gas pumps so the attendant couldn't see us. He was inside watching the Leafs game, surrounded by delicious silver bags of Hostess ketchup-flavored potato chips. I had a cherry blossom chocolate bar, yes, chocolate bar, not candy bar, in my coat for the walk home later. A car pulled up and the driver bought gas. The attendant left, and before the car pulled away, we descended on the car. "Hey, sir, do you have any kids?" The driver answered, "No, why?" "Can we have your power players?" "Can we have your power players?" That winter I must have asked, "Can we have your power players?" at least 100 times. The driver handed over his stack of power players, and before he drove off, he said, "Hold on, boys." He reached into his glove compartment and gave us another 40 stacks of power players. We bolted home, and in the sugar rush of my cherry blossom and the safety of my family's warm apartment, we filled up our power players album. I still have it. Even in December of 1970, at the age of 7, I knew that during that moment at the Esso station, I was having a Canadian experience. Although I had nothing to compare it to, I felt Canadian. A pride came over me. The spirit of the next great nation era extended to industry. In 1968, under the Trudeau government, Canada got into the nuclear reactor business. The government had subsidized the major technological achievement of building the CANDU nuclear reactor. I always thought it was ironic that a country that struggled with entrepreneurship had thrown its hat into such a complicated business and called those reactors, of all things, CANDU. America was a can-do country. Canada was a might-do country. Unfortunately, it's theorized that the CANDU reactor may be where Pakistan got its nuclear weapons program from. But that's for another book. Sorry, eh? In 1969, Montreal once again did us right by getting the first Canadian team in Major League Baseball, the Montreal Expos. The name, of course, was an homage to the highly successful Expo 67. Everything about the Expos franchise was not American. From the name to the softball-style uniforms to the multicolored caps all the way to the weird M logo. The Expos had their first franchise player in Daniel Joseph Rusty Staub, a right fielder with bright red hair. Staub made the classy choice of learning French, and the French-Canadian Montreal fans responded with delight, giving him the nickname Le Grand Orange. I remember watching Expo games on Montreal's French-language CBC channel, CBLFT. The French translations for baseball terms were awesome. For example, baseball was le baseball. The batter was le frappeur. A base runner was un coureur. A foul ball was un fausse ball. A fly ball was un ballon. A pop-up was un chandail. An infield pop-up was un mini chandail. My favorite was the French term for a sacrifice bunt, un amorti sacrifice. Sounds like a cross between a suicide pact and an orgasm. In the 1968 Winter Olympics, Canadian skier Nancy Green won a gold medal, an event so rare that she was hired to do a commercial for Mars Bars. In the commercial, Nancy Green is in front of her trophy case, and someone teases her. In her thick Canadian accent, she says, "Hey, no joking in the trophy room." We thought it was the most Canadian sentence in the world. 32 years later, my brother Paul visited me in L.A. and teased me about my Teen Choice Award, which was a full-size surfboard. Reflexively, I said, Hey, Paul, no joking in the trophy room, eh? You can take the boy out of Canada. In September 1969, it was Toronto's turn to give Canada some glory when it held the Toronto Rock and Roll Revival Festival featuring The Doors, Alice Cooper, Little Richard, and surprise guests John Lennon and Yoko Ono. John and Yoko's performance as the Plastic Ono Band was recorded and released that December. It was the first live album recorded by any member of the Beatles, together or separately. This is the concert where Alice Cooper famously threw a chicken into the crowd, which then, in turn, ripped the chicken apart and threw it back at him. That incident stole many of the headlines, despite the presence of John and Yoko, but for me, I was thrilled that John chose Canada. In December 1969, John Lennon and Yoko Ono returned to Toronto to start their famous War is Over campaign. In an attempt to end the Vietnam War, the Lennons had decided to use their celebrity to sell the concept of peace as if it was a product. They had hoped to begin their advertising-style protest in New York, but because of a trumped-up marijuana charge and a personal vendetta by Richard Nixon, John and Yoko were unable to get into America. So, as an alternative, John and Yoko chose Toronto with the help of Australian-born rock journalist and producer Richie York. Richie was a tireless promoter of Canadian rock and one of the architects of CanCon. Thank you, Mr. York. The simple poster for the War is Over campaign was designed by University of Toronto students, who also donated their time to put the posters all over Toronto. Ultimately, the campaign, which started in Toronto, had billboards all around the world. I found out about the War is Over protest in a traumatic way. On what was possibly the coldest day of my life, in December 1969, my brothers and I were tobogganing. Over the perpetual hum of the 401, we heard a buzzing sound in the sky. It was a skywriter spelling out the word war. A little background into the Canadian psyche. Canadians had the misguided belief that America was preoccupied with invading Canada. It was only years later, when I lived in America, that I realized that Americans view the Great White North not so much as a country, but more, as the popular meme suggests, as America's hat. After seeing war spelled out in the sky, my brother Paul came to the conclusion that, indeed, the Americans were invading. I began to cry uncontrollably out of terror. Every night we had seen the Vietnam War on television, and now it seemed Canada was next. The skywriter then spelled, "Is over." My brother Peter said with certainty, "War is over Canada right now. When we get home, we'll have hot chocolate and begin to form resistance cells." Now it spelled out, "War is over if you." Peter said, "All right, here comes the ultimatum. Obviously it's if you don't give us your oil." Peter shouted to the sky, "Bring it on, you Yankee buggers." I continued to weep. As we marched home, the skywriter completed the message. It read, "War is over if you want it. Happy Xmas. Love, John and Yoko." My crying changed from tears of fear to tears of pride. John Lennon and Yoko were in Toronto. They had personally sent Toronto a Christmas card in the sky. Later that week, we watched John Lennon and Prime Minister Trudeau hanging out in Ottawa. John thought our Prime Minister was cool. I couldn't help but feel the reason John chose Canada was that he knew what we knew. Canada was going to be the next great nation. And if this nation was to be great, it needed to be fit. In the late 1960s, it was observed that the average 30-year-old Canadian had the same level of fitness of the average 60-year-old Swede. For Trudeau, this would not stand. In 1970, he started the Participaction Program, which was a government initiative to raise the fitness level of the nation. At school, Participaction created the Canada Fitness Test. Every child had to go through a series of physical tests and actions to determine their level of fitness, and they were issued an embroidered patch that let any and all know how they had performed. The highest performers received an award of excellence. Below that was gold, then silver, and then the lowly bronze. My brain told me I was going to get the award of excellence. My body quickly informed me that I was to receive silver. People who won the award of excellence tended to put that patch on their denim jacket. We silvers tended to pretend that the patch had fallen through a sewer grate. Having said that, I still have my silver patch. I would have gotten gold, but I stumbled on the shuttle run. I don't have to think about that anymore, right? While Canada was getting fit, domestic issues took center stage. In 1970, Prime Minister Trudeau had to deal with war and violence right here at home in Canada. Canada has always been a nation of two solitudes, English Canada, which comprises the vast majority in 9 out of the 10 provinces, and French Canada, which is the predominant culture of the province of Quebec. The two traditions had forged an uneasy coexistence since the battle at the Plains of Abraham. Quebec was Catholic, English Canada mostly Protestant. United by hockey, divided by language. In the 1960s, a Quebec separatist movement was slowly growing. Although called the Quiet Revolution, there was some violence and loss of life in the form of bombings and armed robberies. I remember seeing mailboxes welded shut in Toronto as a way of combating the rash of mailbox bombings. In 1970, the Quiet Revolution got loud. In what is known as the October Crisis, a Quebec separatist terrorist organization called the Front de la Libération du Québec, or FLQ, kidnapped a British trade minister named James Cross and the deputy premier of Quebec, Pierre Laporte. In response to these kidnappings, a week later, Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau invoked what is known as the War Measures Act, giving the federal government sweeping powers of search and seizure and placing restrictions on freedom of the press. Literally overnight, Canada went from a democracy to a dictatorship. There were soldiers and tanks in the streets of Canada. When the press asked how far Prime Minister Trudeau would go with his suspension of civil liberties in order to defeat the FLQ, he responded, "Just watch me." Just watch me? Is this the mealy-mouthed language of a weak progressive? No, it was pure Trudeau. Trudeau's harsh, draconian response to the FLQ crisis seemed, to many, to be out of character for a progressive liberal, except to those who had read Trudeau's writings on the nature of governance. Unlike many conservatives who want to appear to be tough on matters of law and order, Trudeau actually was ruthless. Not in the interest of offering red meat to the law and order set, but because the FLQ infuriated his sensibilities about the sanctity of the democratic process. Yes, of course, he found the violence of the FLQ repugnant, but what he found equally repugnant was the FLQ's barbaric defiling of the sanctity of democratic choice, whereby authority is granted only to the elected, the just, and the competent, and not to hoodlums, bullies, or fascists. After Prime Minister Trudeau refused the FLQ's demands, Pierre Laporte was apparently executed, though later it would be revealed that he was accidentally killed in a struggle. James Cross was released 58 days after his kidnapping, and although several of his captors were granted their freedom in exchange, 6 were later convicted upon their return to Canada, the FLQ was effectively destroyed. True to Prime Minister Trudeau's word, the Bill of Rights and our tradition of democracy were restored. For a 7-year-old, the crisis was both terrifying and thrilling. Before the October crisis, I'd never seen a Canadian soldier on the street, and up until then, I wasn't aware that we even had tanks. When the newspapers showed the bloody remains of Pierre Laporte in the trunk of a car, I was horrified. For many years afterwards, my brother, Paul, makeshift Morg Myers, would wince every time my dad opened the trunk of our car, expecting to find Pierre Laporte again. In the schoolyards of North York, our tension was transmuted into a macabre game in which you would get sucker punched in the back of the head, and when you turned around to see who hit you, the offender would simply say, "FLQ." And then, in turn, you would FLQ somebody else. I had a bruise in the middle of my back, and when my mom asked me where I got it, I said, "FLQ." My mom misheard that to be, "Fuck you," and she clocked me in the back of the head. We didn't quite know what FLQ meant, but we knew it was bad. We also knew that Trudeau had protected us. My favorite Trudeau memory is the now legendary Fuddle-Duddle scandal. During question period, on the very formal floor of the House of Commons in Ottawa, Prime Minister Trudeau, in response to some particularly personal taunting, flipped a member of the opposition the bird and mouthed the words, "Fuck off." This was seen by everybody in the house. It was like C-SPAN after hours, and the press went crazy. They asked Trudeau, "What were you thinking when you moved your lips?" Trudeau responded, "Well, what is the nature of your thoughts, gentlemen, when you say fuddle-duddle or something like that? God, you guys!" And then he walked off. He was caught saying fuck off, and he claimed to have said fuddle-duddle. That is a big set of nuts. The next day, a Canadian candy company put out a form of toffee called fuddle-duddle with a caricature of Trudeau on the label. Trudeau inspired us. We may not have had an interesting past, but we were sure as hell going to have an interesting future. Canada became future crazy. There was even a very forward-thinking show about futurism called Here Come the 70s that was shot in Toronto, and it featured a theme song played on a Moog synthesizer. Here Come the 70s holds up to this day, not only in its prescience, but as a fascinating artifact of a time when futurism was a current concept and not something we now find ourselves nostalgic for. By this point, Marshall McLuhan had moved back to Canada and was continuing his then-controversial, pioneering study of mass media at the University of Toronto. It was here that he wrote From Cliché to Archetype. Under McLuhan, this new field of media studies eschewed the tired orthodoxy of print in favor of the new electronic media of television and satellite broadcasts. Though he spoke of the world as a global village, his futuristic revolutionary work was not being done in Paris or New York, but in Canada. Downtown Toronto, in the spirit of new is better than old, was going through a radical change. Every day, another new, modern building. To make room for these new buildings, Toronto tore down many of its more beautiful historic buildings. In its place were lots of concrete, jagged lines, as if inspired by Hitler's Atlantic Wall or the Luftwaffe's flak towers that ring Berlin. In Toronto at this time, the wrecking ball business and the concrete industry were booming, and we're still paying the architectural price. Some old buildings survived because they were being repurposed. The Victorian houses were being made into neo-Victorian clothing stores. Toronto had embraced the new trend of psychedelia, and I remember going downtown to Yorkville to, quote-unquote, see the hippies, and feeling proud that Toronto had hippies. People were swimming nude in the Don River. We literally saw bare-naked ladies. We had arrived. In 1971, not everyone rejected the old. The great Canadian historian Pierre Burton captured the fervor surrounding the next great nation era with his smash hit book, The Last Spike. Burton was the Ken Burns of his time, and The Last Spike told the story of the Canadian Pacific Railway. Pierre Burton is a hero to me. He taught us that we do have stories to tell. I used to love seeing him on Canadian TV and hearing him talk about the otherwise dry story of Canada in such an interesting way. He was calming. Equally calming was the 1972 TV series The Beachcomber, starring Bruno Gerussi. It was set in British Columbia, and it was about a coastal community that had to deal with the scourge of driftwood. I watched The Beachcombers every day after school for many years, and yet I still cannot tell you what happens in any individual episode. The Beachcombers is inexplicable to non-Canadians. I shall not attempt to explain it. I have one word for you, YouTube. Though that is really two words stuck together. Perhaps the most defining moment of the next great nation era is the 1972 Summit Series, an 8-game hockey tournament between Canada and the Soviet Union. For me, the story of the Summit Series really comes down to three moments when we felt that this hockey tournament was further proof of Canada's inevitable emergence. The first was the speech. The second was the chant. And the third was the goal. I warn you that I cannot be a dispassionate historian when it comes to the 72 series. This was very personal for me, and very meaningful and joyful. I love the game of hockey, how it looks, how it sounds, and in the good old days when Maple Leaf Gardens was still around, how it smelled, from the smell of the garden's oversalted popcorn, to the smell of overly strong cologne, to the smell of electricity.